This week's episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 3rd of July on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, we hear about electric appliances powered by human breath, a method of furniture production that puts energy back into the environment, and a giant cake church. Whoever said design was all about chairs? Ahead on the show, we travel to Berlin and sit down with architect Georg Bummeler to talk about his home city's architectural conundrums.
Berlin has a certain inspiration because of its structure, you know, its morphology, and that is, of course, you know, you find that in the buildings you do here.
We hear from British furniture designer Gareth Neal about his plans to make furniture without using a scrap of energy.
When you start taking every atom of the process and breaking it all down, you realise that every step of the way we're burning carbon on this mission. Where do you draw the line?
And we find out why St Bride's Church in London has been reincarnated as a very big cake.
It's 100% accurate. It's a scale model that's built from the drawings that we borrowed from the church itself.
We'll also visit MAN, the Paris menswear trade show that promotes cozy business operations for small brands. Our New York editor, Aisha Spears, and business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, take us through their Fashion Week finds and follies. We'll also visit the studio of designer João Paulo Lamolia in Rio de Janeiro. That's all to come on episode 38 of Section D, here on Monocle 24. Now, you may remember in last week's Section D that we dropped in on Zurich, the number one city in our Monocle Quality of Life survey, to find out a little about what makes it tick. Well, this week we're tackling Berlin. It's a city that dropped somewhat in this year's survey from 8 to 18 due to building and infrastructure delays and setbacks. Architect Georg Bummeler has been building in the city since the 1980s. He's witnessed the highs and lows of Berlin's urban development. We sent Melanie Shevchenko to hear about his thoughts and experiences on life as an architect in a city that's stuck in a bit of a building rut.
Place where he usually goes. This is sort of inspired by these Egyptian ideas, you know, with these prayer niches they have in these Egyptian temples, you know, with the sand in it, you see here.
Berlin-based architect Georg Bummeler shows me one of his favorite buildings in the south of Berlin. It's the crematorium, an intense conceptual structure, massive interior pillars that extend to pocket skylights in the ceiling, spotting the concrete floor with brilliant coins of light.
You know, when you are like in this situation where you lose somebody or whatever, he didn't want these people to sort of like be waiting in front of the chapel. He wanted them to they all have the same problem or the same, that they share each other, but with the columns, they are not alone. You know, it's like almost like beings, you know, where you are sort of, can be closer to each other and be more.
Back at his office in the south district of Oberschöneweide, Bummeler tells me that every site for which he has designed a building brings a particular inspiration, typically from its historical and morphological environment, as he calls it.
Berlin has a certain inspiration because of its structure, you know, its morphology, and that is, of course, you know, you find that in the buildings you do here. Before the war, I mean, the kind of urban development here and the city planning actually in all these centers is very interesting, you know. It started like many smaller towns which stayed small, like with the Baroque urban design or Classicist urban design. And Berlin has kind of almost precedence for these designs, you know, like the Friedrichstadt, you know, Friedrichstadt is a Baroque city extension. It's very unique and it's discussed all over the planet, you know, because it's so identifiable. And then the Hobrecht plan, that was like the late 19th century when Berlin grew like mad. These bald structures were designed and they were kind of, you know, with enormous identities, you know, and we still live in this city fabric, which was created basically at around that time. I mean, urbanistically, lots of the main development stopped around in the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, we are still living in these limits of the city of then.
Boehmiller says that even after the Berlin Wall came down, not much has changed.
Right, that was a very interesting time, of course, but actually the city plan wasn't changed much, you know, the layout and the fabric of blocks and streets and all that, that stayed the same. There was a kind of a sort of a conservative approach in the 90s, you know. I mean, there were like lots of radical ideas, and they didn't quite happen because the politics and their planning commissions, they decided for a kind of tame, almost tame, attempt, you know, but the structure of the city was so solid, you know, that lots of like interesting set pieces or designs were able to be constructed, and they now are new icons, you know, of this late 20th century development.
Boehmiller has been an architect for 25 years. His career was launched when he won a building competition, back when the Berlin Wall was still up. Since then, 80% of his work lies in public buildings. Most notably is the Bundesschlange, literally translating to the federal snake, which is visible from Berlin's main train station. Built in the late 1990s, the Bundesschlange is a 500-meter-long, serpentine-curved housing complex that was originally intended for Berlin's government employees, as it sits quite close to the Bundestag, or the National Parliament buildings. To Boehmiller, Berlin is lacking the drive towards new architectural plans that would bring some cohesion to the capital.
It probably has to do with democracy or with this late capitalism or whatever. I feel that it's a lot of piecemeal. There is no vision. I don't see any identifiable streak or whatever. There are enormous urban potentials, and Berlin has seized them yet. There's so many institutions and politicians and all that talking into any project. I mean, there is no space for some visionary architecture. It's a city full of potential. You know, I mean, just as you took your bike out, you saw this huge street, you know, Adlergestelle. This could be a grand boulevard going like from the airport to town. I mean, it could be the Champs-Élysées of Berlin, right? But instead, they built building markets and gas stations, right? You know, maybe in literature, you know, there are good descriptions about this mood here. You know, it's sort of a city of lost chances or whatever, which could be a nice place for another generation because it's not finished, you know.
The idea of an unfinished city is an attractive pull for residents, tourists, and investors, because there's always room to move forward. But not with projects that are designed to fill in the gaps, says Boehmiller. Take, for example, the recreation of the Stadtschloss, the royal palace in the center of Berlin that was damaged by Allied bombing in World War II. In 1950, East German authorities demolished the Stadtschloss, despite West German protests. Following the reunification of Germany, plans to rebuild it have been circulating. Opponents of the project, however, argue that a new building would be a pastiche of former architectural styles, not to mention expensive, with no definitive economic benefit. Today, the site remains empty. One side is a construction site, and the other has been turned into a temporary park. A sound installation cutting through the center of the site plays field recordings from various attractions in Berlin.
We don't have right now the political situation and the economic situation which force us to make like clear decisions, and then I think you should just as well accept it and leave it open for a generation to come. What's the rush?
For now, it seems like Berliners don't want to rush. In fact, it's almost as though they're working against progress, particularly in the wake of rapid gentrification.
I think Berlin is a wonderful place to live because you have the best of both worlds, because there is not so much economic pressure. It leaves so much freedom.
That was Melanie Shevchenko with architect Georg Bummeler in Berlin. Next week, we'll be heading to Lisbon for our design dispatch to hear how architects there are balancing preservation with innovation in the city's built environment. But in the meantime, we're off to Rio de Janeiro after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Hot on the heels of the Rio Plus 20 summit, sustainability is the buzzword in the city's design crowd. And one Carioca industrial designer is going further than most. João Paulo Lamolia has devised some extraordinary things that range from a sun-tanning, UV-protected chair to electric appliances powered by human breath. Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter met up with João Paulo in Rio de Janeiro to hear how these innovative ideas have become a reality.
Hi, my name is João Paulo Lamolia, and I'm an industrial designer from Brazil, and I love sustainability. I'm not designing things to go on to sale. My great idea is to inspire other people to think in other eco-friendly solutions.
Sitting in the middle of the lush green Jardim Botânico in Rio de Janeiro, it's not hard to see where João Paulo's love for sustainability comes from. Tropical tree trunks here seem to crawl on the ground, and the almost endless green vines appear to climb up into the sky. The nature in this so-called marvelous city is inspiring to even the most urban of dwellers. And this 27-year-old industrial designer hopes that his inspiring concepts will rub off on others.
What I do are concepts. I actually have these ideas to inspire other people, and I think that if a designer doesn't look for sustainability, he's not a designer anymore. He's just an artist or maybe something. Design is all about functionality today.
João Paulo has transformed his sustainable way of thinking into more than just art. His quadro chair is a perfect example of functionality. A wooden chair with four drawers where the chair legs would normally be is the perfect space-saving design for people with increasingly shrinking apartments in ever-growing cities across the globe. But the quadro chair is just one of João Paulo's designs that's been turned into products. Most of his designs are still concepts, with his favorite design concept being the Ari mask. He explains how it works.
It's a mask that converts the kinetic energy of the wind, of your breath wind, into electrical energy to recharge small electronic devices such as a smartphone or something like that.
We take a walk through Rio's picturesque neighborhood, Lagoa, and João Paulo tells me how he hopes to make this concept a reality one day with the help of engineers and physicists. He takes out a prototype of the Ari mask on hand, and he shows how it could be used if you were going for a run.
I'm going to show you how to use it. You just strap into your face and breathe. Just start to breathe. And with this cable, the USB cable, you just plug it in on your smartphone or whatever you want, and just start breathing and charging it. This is the Ari mask.
The Ari mask was so well received by the design community that it won the Red Dot Award for Best Design Concept in Singapore earlier this year. And even though the mask is still just an idea, he thinks that the concept does have a place as a useful product in the future, especially with consumer buying habits being on the rise for handheld electronics.
I actually can see this kind of technology being used in a medical area or camping, rescue suits, space trips. Yeah, it's actually very plausible. It can happen, but like I said, not for now. The idea is the first one in the world. It's like never one had thought this before. And I think this is good for the humanity because we now can explore different solutions.
But this isn't a first for João Paulo. He's designed several other concepts that fuse functional design with science.
I designed a sneaker that in the sole you have a Kinect system, generation system. For example, when you are walking, you are spending energy. So the sneaker convert this energy, the Kinect energy of your movement, into electrical energy, and then you just put a USB cable and you recharge your smartphone just by walking.
Really?
Yes.
And how has that been received so far?
It's a concept yet, but it was well received. I won Brazilian award. It was very well received. But like I said, in Brazil, technology is not advancing like we want to. I have a doormat that when you are rubbing your feet, cleaning it, you generate energy, and there is a doorbell into the device, and you just step in the bell and then the energy is free.
Thank you for joining us. Today's press conference is an opportunity to share another important update about achievement of Rio Plus 20.
And just weeks after world leaders, members of the private sector and NGOs gathered in this Brazilian city for the Rio Plus 20 summit, what most critics claim was a complete failure at decreasing global warming and increasing sustainability, João Paulo believes that his design concepts can be part of a solution to create a more environmentally friendly and sustainable world. He believes that a difference in sustainability can be done from people like him at a grassroots level.
Because I think that the world needs something else always, and the politicians are not ready to do that. I think that we have to stop to look us as problems. We are actually solutions. I think we should be brave and to assume the moral courage to try to think, try to change things. I think that if we inspire good things, it's worth it.
That was Sheena Rossiter with carioca designer João Paulo Lamolia in Rio. And if you thought João Paulo's Darth Vader energy harnessing was extreme, our next subject is going even further in his quest to cut carbon emissions. British designer Gareth Neal is embarking on a carbon-negative furniture project. What does that mean? Well, Gillian Tobias sat down with him in our Midori House studios earlier to find out.
The project title's In Pursuit of Carbon Negative. A lot of people know the term carbon neutral, but carbon negative is something else. It's where the process of what you do and the actions that you take while making an object counterbalance the amount of carbon that you use while making an object. So put simply, the project's about me trying to make a product that takes more carbon from the environment than I put in during making it. So essentially, I'm going to be cycling all the way to Hereford to a particular woodland where two trees were felled in the winter, which is when you're meant to fell timber. And so they're in a green state at the moment. And then for a period of 4 days, when I get to the woods, I'm going to be making a series of products that then we'll bring back to London and show during London Design Week.
Talk a little bit about the properties of wood in terms of its relationship to the environment.
Well, the great thing about timber or trees in the sense is when they're growing, they're taking carbon from the environment. So essentially, they're carbon sinks. So as they grow, they're taking the carbon out and they're storing it within the timber. Now, if a tree is managed correctly and is a woodland is looked after respectfully, then it will continue to always take the same amount of carbon out of the environment, even if you harvest a tree within that woodland itself. And we're going to be using ash, which is one of the greatest removers of carbon in terms of a species of tree. And it's also the best for green woodworking. So it's a perfect timber for it. It's light in colour, so we're going to get some beautiful objects. All the material itself is going to be processed by hand, so we're going to be splitting the timber, we'll be using traditional pole lathes, adzes and side axes, and bit and brace to drill the holes and sculpt and create the objects. So we're very much looking at it as an archaeological project, in the sense looking back in time over the processes that perhaps contemporary designers have missed out on, and also really, really taking a microscopic look at the delivery and the networks involved in getting to the job, I suppose, and delivering the work. Hence the kind of the diet that I'm going to be eating as well. So So the minute you start looking at it, you've got to think about everything. So that's the food. You know, I take sugar in my tea, so I'm not going to be able to have sugar in my tea. The water, the amount, where do you wash on the ride? You know, the flushing of the toilet. You know, and when you start taking every atom of the process and breaking it all down, you realize that every step of the way, you know, we're burning carbon on this mission. And where do you draw the line? And at what point do we, you know, at what point do companies need to go to, and how do they need to think about resources and supply chains, you know, in regards to localism, I suppose.
It is a very interesting journey on all fronts, and I'm wondering what your ultimate aim is in terms of the wider implications for the design industry.
Well, I think I'm going to be talking about it over LDF. So once the experiment's over and the research is over and the products are made, then we will be selling those. But the idea really is to expose the information and the data, because we'll be performing a life cycle analysis on the whole process, and once we've got that data, we'll have the evidence that can then help inform the industry more.
Do you think it is a bit utopian, or do you think there is a reality that people are going to sit up and take notice and it will actually take effect in some of the furniture making communities?
I think it's time that we started trying to approach things with more of the utopian dream. I do think the project has that kind of idealistic impracticalities, and there, you know, there is no end of problems when thinking about this for companies. But I think, you know, in the way that the marketplace is at the moment, certainly in London and farmers market, then within the food industry, we're already there. So we've just got to start thinking about this now in terms of products. And I don't see why we can't take aspects of what I'm trying to do and project them onto our own companies. But yes, there's a dreamy state to it. There's a utopian kind of ideal and dream. And yes, ideally, I don't think we can all live in the woods and, live a diet. But we can just take parts of that. And I think that's what it's for. It's as a promotion to see what elements other people can embrace.
Well, for the consumer, real objects of desire in terms of the final piece, but also with a philosophy and a belief behind it.
Yeah, and the objects will have so much more meaning, and, you know, they have an emotional quality and a tacit quality that you just wouldn't get off a machine. And I think that in itself is what's going to make the things that I produce so hopefully worthwhile and desirable.
That was Gareth Neal with his heroic effort to make furniture without taking any energy from the environment at all. And we'll be checking back with Gareth on his journey later in the summer to see how he's getting on. In the meantime, though, a musical reprieve. Here's Norwegian Wood by the Beatles. You're listening to Section D. That was Norwegian Wood by the Beatles. The men's spring-summer 2013 collections have just come to a close in Paris. Away from the drama of the big name fashion houses, there's a wealth of business and buying taking place in smaller, more intimate venues, showrooms and trade fairs. Man is one such trade show, now in its second season. We sent our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, along to see how it's faring.
Over the last week, the international menswear crowd has been making their biannual pilgrimage around Europe, visiting shows and designers in Florence, Milan and Paris. Last week, the Grand Tour finished in France's capital and one of the most recent additions to the circuit. The Man Show, an intimate trade show in the Marais, is home to brands like Folk, Lacoste Live and Sunspell. With Pitti in Florence, the White Show in Milan and Capsule and Trenoy already in Paris, is there room for yet another men's trade show? I met with the men behind Man, Antoine Flock, Romain Benedict-James and Olivier Migdat, to find out what sets them apart.
So we have, let's say, around like 30 brands. The main idea with Man from the beginning, since we created it at the end of October, was to, because our knowledge on trade shows and big exhibitions and stuff like this, each of us, we agreed that it was very important for us to begin very small, not only because it was the first show, but because it was a real decision to start small. And then keep the same number of brands for the second season to really install the show. And then we will try to grow it next season, maybe to 45, 50 brands, then keep it to 50. And then when we arrive to 80 in a couple of years, we will make sure we have the best brands, the best 80 brands. And that's why we don't like to call Man a trade show. You know, Romain and Olivier, they have an agency called Imagineers. They're organizing exhibitions. They are like they appear like curators. So it's very important to see Man like as curators. We just want to show what we think is men's fashion today. We're trying to have a good mix of brands from brands like YMC, who have been there for many, many years, or Oliver Spencer. To younger brands like Waiting for the Sun, the wooden sunglasses, to and Pam also, more a bit more designer. It's important not to go into one field of men's fashion.
Two popular brands who are showing at Man are British label Folk and Stockholm's Uniforms for the Dedicated. Cathal from Folk explains why they've moved to Man this season.
We wanted a smaller environment, so more showroom-like, and the show we were with unfortunately moved quite far away, and I'm a kind of lazy guy, so we're here. Business-wise, it's good. The beginning show always gives people an idea that we've done a job properly, so it kind of secures budgets. We don't write too much at the shows, but basically it lets people know we've done our job well.
Frederick from Uniforms for the Dedicated thinks the show's intimacy is key to its success.
We just moved after six consecutive seasons at Capsule. Just felt the time to do something new, something smaller, something a bit more selected, simply. Yeah. Really happy with the first, well, the prime location and the first day.
Great. And yes, that's the thing, it's the first day, so it's hard to, in a way, assess how the rest of the weekend will go, but this morning has been busy.
Very busy. I think it's like a perfect bridge from Pitti last week, and just sort of I get the feeling that the buyers come here with another sort of perspective. They sort of come here with a more of an open sense somehow. I understand that the massive players need to be around, without a doubt, and they have their charm, and the likes of Pitti is good because it's divided quite well, done it smart, but overall we do 80% of our business from our showrooms. We have showrooms throughout Europe, and for Paris we're aiming to set up a showroom to balance the Man Show still staying. So I'd say yes, this is way more our alley than the bigger fairs, but the right alley is even more our own showrooms.
And at fairs like this, who are you meeting? So do you make many, you're saying 80% of the deals, 80% of the writing comes in the showrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you hope to meet here? Is it meeting people who's discovering the brand for the first time and then might come back and visit you at a showroom? Is it press? What's the importance of being somewhere like this?
I think it's mainly three things. It's press, absolutely. It's existing customers who are on markets where we don't have showrooms close by. And it is mainly then a lot of new traffic especially Asian, China, South Korea, and primarily Japan, because we don't have a showroom in Asia, so sort of all our Asian business is done in Paris over 3 days, and that's a very growing part for us.
While intimacy is key to Matin's identity, growth must also be on their mind. The trio who run it are determined to keep the show's cozy atmosphere, even as their brand roster grows. For them, the important thing is selecting the right brands. Antoine Flock from Man again.
I think it's important for us when we choose a brand, the brands for the show, we're really looking at the brand and the identity of the brand and which market they are sold. We do a lot of research on the brand before saying, yes, okay, you can do it. And I think the space we're using for Man will be always important because it's part of the identity of Man. And it's important to have venues where people feel good and also some venues where that, you know, 80% of the brands are coming from outside of France. So it's important to have a nice French venue with wooden floor and like a nice little building, and you know, it adds some charm in to the show. There was a gap for a small, well organized, created, and small. I will say small again, because when you start small and within a few years you become really big, the people who have been there from the beginning feel a bit lost within the show because you have too many people who are doing the same thing as brands who have been doing that for 15 years. And making sure every season to have the good ones and keep a good relationship with the existing ones and growing it slowly, it's important.
With Trenoy, Capsule and numerous smaller showrooms in Paris, Man entered what looked like a fairly saturated trade show market when it launched last season. 6 months on, its intimate setup is not only attracting important brands, but international press and buyers. It's clear that for the well-heeled fashion set, a little bit of charm goes a long way, even at a trade show. For Section D, I'm Aisha Spears.
And back from Paris, Aisha Spears joins me now in Studio 2 of Midori House, together with Jonathan Openshaw, Monocle's business editor, who was in attendance at Pitti and Milan and Paris. Aisha, you were just in Milan and Paris, but it's probably enough. No. Thank you very much for that wonderful package. The thing that strikes me is, obviously, it's a crowded market, like you ended up saying, but they have managed to spot a gap. Can these things only be sustained for so long before they grow too big? I know that Antoine Flock, the organiser there, said that by the time they reached 80 brands, that was enough. And it would be very much a sort of survival of the fittest in terms of the brands that were selected. But is that an idealistic approach?
I mean, I think so. I think that obviously people want to grow. And I think a lot of trade shows have probably started out saying, oh, we're small, we're intimate, the word curated gets used so much. We've curated this selection of brands that fit together and it's perfect and that you can get nice coffee and come and have a glass of water and be friendly with us and then hopefully do a story or buy something. I think a lot of trade shows start out like that and then success comes and that changes things. Perhaps with Man, because they've seen that happen, they won't go down that path. But, you know, to go from 30 brands to 80 in a couple of years is a big change. And a lot of it, you know, we hear Antoine say, a lot of it is about the space they're in. They're in a lovely space, which feels like a townhouse in a sense, an opened up townhouse. It's in the Marais and it's very, very intimate. And I think you'd lose that with 80 brands.
And at the other end of the spectrum, Pitti is obviously one of the more established trade shows for fashion. John, how does that feel? It's been going for years and years.
I mean, yeah, listening to the package on Man, obviously, which is just in this very nascent trade show. Pitti was in its 82nd edition this season, and you're talking about 30,000 buyers descending on the Fortezza di Basso, which is this kind of incredible old Medici fortress in the heart of Florence. It feels like a landmark in the industry because it is this squat fortress, and it is kind of a landmark in the menswear industry. And I think they've managed to really kind of own that. It's the beginning of the season. It's before things kick off in Milan. It's before things go on to develop in Paris.
Full fatigue has set in.
Yes, someone's fresh face. No one's as hungover as they're.
But do people still buy very much at Pitti?
But people are there to look. This is what we've always, you know, ever since we've been reporting on Pitti, people have said they go there to kind of see the menswear industry turned inside out. It's a beautiful setting. You have because there's such a range of brands and such a range of buyers, you do kind of get a sense of looking down on the kind of central courtyard of the whole of menswear left exposed. You've got, you know, your kind of guys from Okayama, and you've got the kind of more glitzy, razzle-dazzle Italians. And just going around talking to people, having coffee with people, you can pick up on trends. If you're there to pick up on trends, you can pick up on the change in buying patterns. And so it's much more about that. People don't actually tend to place orders as much there because it's the beginning of the season, and they say that they go on to place orders in showrooms towards the end. But it's still very important from a kind of brand message point of view.
And Aisha, at Man, do you notice that people are placing orders?
I think, I mean, like, we had both folk and uniforms for the dedicated saying that, you know, the majority of writing, as they say, when the actual money gets put onto the table, happens in showrooms. And so what's interesting about somewhere like, well, the way the calendar works, even with Paris, so Milan having fallen just before it, a lot of the buyers aren't even in Paris for the shows. They're getting there a few days later. And so there's an overlap. There's a little bit of scheduling issue with people buying, doing their writing in Milan, not making it to Paris in time. I think that there, you know, we heard folks say that it's about showing that you're ready. We're here. Here's the collection. And come and visit us in the showroom and probably put some money down. The odd thing I did hear about the Man show is that a lot of the people there weren't able to sell to the American market, which was a bit of a flaw, I think, because they've obviously got either the licensing issues or some sort of strategy where they don't want to sell to the Americans yet. And so that cuts off a huge market that's visiting Paris.
And the market that comes to Paris is what I was going to ask you about later on, but we may as well talk about it now. Who's there in terms of sort of nationalities? Is it majority Americans come over for Paris, maybe not for Milan? The Japanese tend to go to Milan, maybe not Paris?
It's more a different kind of shop. So in Milan, obviously, it's a tailoring industry. So you've got more high-end people there. In Paris, you'll get people who are there for sportswear, because they'll be visiting some showrooms that are showing sportswear. There'll also be the same buyers in Milan who are there to see Hermès and Louis Vuitton, have all those kind of appointments. But I think in Paris, you've got a much greater range of things to see. You'll see Dior Homme, and then you'll see Rick Owens and Comme des Garçons, and that's just on the high end of things. So I think that you've got a much greater selection. In terms of nationalities, it's the same. It's, you know, the Europeans, obviously, the Americans have a big presence in Paris, as do this is the Asian market.
Finally, I know it's been a long few weeks for you as you've traipsed your way through Europe, but I couldn't let you go without asking both of you for a highlight and an absolute lowlight, maybe a trend that none of us should be seen dead in.
Well, highlight for me from Pitti, I think, was there were some really lovely remakes of brands which had fallen by the wayside. So we saw a brand called Troy Shirt Makers, who had been brought back by Gitman Brothers. And they used to have, I think they had something like 68% of the American shirt market in the 1940s. And they disappeared. And now, so they're being brought back. They were really great. And there's a lovely brand called Hancock, which is coming from a guy who used to work at Macintosh. So that was great. And a low light for me was the difficulty in getting air conditioning during the Italian heat waves, especially at the parties they have in the evening at these beautiful kind of Rococo palazzos. They actually light candelabra, but can't put air conditioning in.
Oh, no.
So it just looks
sweat patches everywhere.
All the guests look like they've been doused in honey. It was horrendous.
And that's actually a major issue for trade shows, because one of the reasons that Capsule, I think, moved in Paris, moved locations this season to this beautiful location on the Seine, moved from a garage in the Marais, was because this garage obviously had no air conditioning, and this time last year everyone was sweltering and you just didn't want to hang out in there at all.
Not a very nice environment for buying. I share a highlight and a low light.
Highlight, I think, comes from Paris. Berluti, the shoe brand, which is in its second season of becoming a full-on ready-to-wear menswear brand, run by Antoine Arnault, part of the LVMH group. They did an incredible presentation in the Palais Royal, which is one of my favourite places in Paris. Anyway, it was really beautiful. They set up vignettes of all their looks as you walk through this kind of garden maze, and it was romantic and lovely. So I thought that was a brilliant presentation. Low light would probably be Trinoy, the entire trade show of Trinoy, which which is a pretty sketchy trade show. It's quite hard to find good brands there. And not only that, it seems to be that they've decided that playing some sort of depressing trance music is what gets people into the space, which it doesn't. And it's this weird kind of like, let's keep going, kind of 90s trance. And then once you're in there, the brands who are in there look like they've been listening to 90s trance since the 90s and don't look very happy at all.
Well, welcome back, both of you, and thank you very much for joining me, Aisha Spheres and Jonathan Openshaw.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful woman. Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in a garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. St Bride's Church on London's Fleet Street isn't just one of Sir Christopher Wren's architectural masterpieces in the city. It's also been adopted by the local media companies as the journalists' church. After 300 years, it finds itself in a dire state of disrepair. Earlier this year, the Inspire Appeal was launched to raise money to keep the church standing. In celebration of the London Festival of Architecture, currently taking place in the capital, last week, renowned architect Sir Terry Farrell gave a talk at St Bride's, and a rather large cake effigy of the church was unveiled. Our reporter, Adrian Craddock, was there to see and taste for himself.
If there was ever a street that needed a church, it's Fleet Street. For the last few hundred years, it's been the traditional home of London's newspaper industry. The wild cohorts of its resident journalists and publishers earned it the nickname, the Street of Shame. When the hacks want to confess their sins, they go to St Bride's, a tall spire church redesigned by Christopher Wren after the Great Fire of London. Much like the neighbouring newspaper houses, St Bride's history has been somewhat rocky. It's been completely destroyed on numerous occasions, and only its famous spire survived the Blitz. In recent years, Parisians have noticed the exterior has started to crumble, prompting a drive to restore its facade. I went along to the inaugural Wren Talk, a lecture organised to both celebrate one of London's most important architects and raise money for the church's repairs. I started by speaking to St Bride's rector, David Mirror.
The building that we see today is Wren's shell, but rebuilt in the 1950s after the bombing, not exactly as it was before the firebomb burnt out all the church, but as the architect, who was a chap called Godfrey Allen, who was the surveyor to the fabric at St Paul's Cathedral, and he was given the job, and he sort of created what he felt was in the spirit of Wren, but wasn't actually a direct copy of what was here before. And you get a very open space, made of the finest English oak, with this massive reredos at the east end, Belgian and Italian marble on the floor, the finest building material, no expense spared, largely through the generosity of the newspaper groups who were all round about then in Fleet Street, and who very much wanted their church to be restored and rebuilt.
It's very interesting you say that, because St Bride's is called the Journalist Church, is that right?
It certainly is. It's also called the Printers' Church, because printers were here long before journalists. But very much from the beginning of the end of the 19th, beginning years of the 20th century, when the presses really established themselves round here, they began to build a very close relationship. And all the sort of big occasions, journalist memorials, carol services and so on, are still celebrated here. And even though the presses have scattered now all across London, they still look to St Bride's as their spiritual home and love coming back here and reconnecting with Fleet Street. Journalists are people of... They value tradition, and they like to feel that they're rooted... You know, in the days when Fleet Street was a village, particularly an older generation of journalists, look back on with great nostalgia. And so I think they find just to have a sort of spiritual anchor is a rather a comforting thing.
The first Wren talk was delivered by the acclaimed English architect Sir Terry Farrell, who spoke about Christopher Wren's ultimately unsuccessful plan for London after the Great Fire.
He was trying to build in St. Paul's something from the continent of a grand Renaissance classical building, formality and geometry. And he tried to impose that on the whole of the city after the fire. But those kind of plans have, certainly in British cities and towns, have never ever worked because we work with incremental change. I read Wren's parish churches on many levels, as you might have guessed from my position. I think it is an extraordinarily iconic thing. The invention of form, the invention of that tower with the stepped elements in it, which is the inspiration for the wedding cake, of course. The love and affection that the British have for it in restoring it or restoring it with interpretation. The history of it is absolutely extraordinary. And I love the urban setting, the alleyways, and the way I described it as a ship that's come into a port, because it's got all the components of a church, a churchyard and a wall around it. It's as though it's floated in, but it's a piece. It's not as though it gives way too much to the streets and alleyways around it, but it's wonderful to come across it. It's such a complete piece.
The other draw of the Inspire appeal is a 5-foot replica of St. Bride's made entirely out of Victoria sponge. The cake is an inverse pun on the story that St. Bride's spire gave a local baker the inspiration to create what would become the precursor to the modern tiered wedding cake. John Robertson's architecture firm helped design and construct the model. John was there to cut the cake and explain how it was made.
In the cake, and the one overriding remark that came back to all of us when they saw the cake was, is it a cake or is it a fake? And so I think what we're about to do is put that to the test.
We decided to commission a cake maker to work with us with all the accurate drawings of the church to make the cake that you've seen this afternoon. It's 100% accurate. It's a scale model that's built from the drawings that we borrowed from the church itself. The cake arrived in our office last Thursday. Paul Finch was very kind to launch our exhibition, and the purpose of it being in our office was that we, as part of the London Festival of Architecture, we exhibited the cake together with a small exhibition of the restoration and repair proposals for the church.
While Fleet Street's publishing houses and newspaper offices may have been transformed to house investment banks and law firms, St. Bride's has kept its reputation as the journalist's church. The nickname is more than just a reference to those who frequent the pews. It relates to a much deeper sense of ownership. In the 1940s, when the church was almost levelled by German bombers, newspaper men pooled their funds to help return it to its former glory. Hopefully, though they might now be a few postcodes away, the same can happen to again save Christopher Wren's neoclassic masterpiece. After all, you just have to look at the Leveson Inquiry to know that the UK press will always need somewhere to repent.
That was Adrian Craddock at St. Bride's Fleet Street in London. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Inspired by an indecent amount of cake, next week we'll be talking Fit Cities with David Burney, New York's Commissioner for Design and Construction, and Mirko Zardini, Director of the Canadian Centre for Architecture. We'll also be taking a whistle-stop tour of contemporary Singaporean graphic design and communist Russian sports posters too, so be sure to tune in then. Playing you out for all those who weren't able to attend the cake cutting at St. Bride's Fleet Street, here's If I'd Known You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake, as performed by Eileen Barton in 1950. This week's show was produced by Alexander Mills and Gillian DeBias. It was edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.
Come in! Well, 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 look who's here! I haven't seen you in many a year!
come and I'd bake a cake, bake a cake, bake a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd bake a cake. Hatchy-do, hatchy-do, hatchy-do. Had you dropped me a letter, I'd hired a band, grand band in the land. Had you dropped me a letter.